Welcome to the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm Blaine Prowse.
And I'm Jonathan Fraser.
We're here with Chris Hancock, Megan Halstead, and young Samuel at the Halstead Farm in Merville. Oh, and John's here too.
And I'm here too, actually. Yeah, we're really excited. We got to do a nice little farm tour today. Check out the lambs and the pigs and the chickens. So it was quite interesting and get a good tour of the farm here. So.
And the ravens.
And the ravens.
We're recording outside in their garden. It's, well, the skies are ominous, but we're hoping for the best that it doesn't rain on us and soak my computer. But anyway, we'll take it as it comes. And so, yeah, Chris, you want to introduce yourself and give us a little bio?
Yeah, so I've been farming here for 4 years with Megan, who grew up here. And when we came here, the farm had pretty much lain dormant for 12 years or so. And so it was, everything was here, but we had to basically dig it out and and start over. So we started out with chickens, and it's the next year we got pigs, and the year after that we got sheep, and here we are 4 years later, and somewhere along the way, we got certified organic, and still are today. We're, you know, farming organically and using organic methods for farming. We sell our product at the farmer's market and through people in town, a couple of stores, and we've sold at restaurants before, and it's been a really beautiful life out here for the last 4 years, and I'm excited about all the possibilities that could happen.
So. Yeah, you have a wonderful piece of land there. I can see there's just unlimited potential.
Yeah.
How large is the property here?
It's 160 acres, 154 actually, point something, by the time you take the road off. Yeah, and it's been in the family since 1958. Wow. When my dad first moved here with his first family, and then my sister and I were raised here, and we have half brother and half sister who were also raised here. So out of the four of us, I'm the one that decided I needed to have this as my life's work, same way that it was for my dad. So I guess we came back, you know, after I convinced Chris that he had to be a farmer if he wanted to stay with me.
That was not hard.
Not once I brought him here and he saw it. Where we are, and you know, we're amazingly close to the beach and you know, Mount Washington and all these things. It's pretty much heaven, I think, for us anyway. So, but our main vision coming here was to try and create a full-on system, if we can, or an organically managed agroecosystem, following on from my degree at UBC. So, yeah, that's been our vision and our work so far.
Cool. Yeah, it's impressive. You just need to find a way to get all that Scotch broom down.
Yeah.
All the labor.
Yeah. Yeah. Been trying to find ways of doing it with animals, but. Yeah.
That's 12-year-old Scotch broom.
Yeah. You sort of have a
stalks as thick as your wrist.
Yeah.
Or thicker.
It's slowly going down, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to see the chicken paddock and all the grass that they get to play in and peck for bugs, and down to the sheep or the pig pen where they're in the forest and scratching the trees up and rooting through the mud. And I got to go in the pen with Chris and get pushed around by the boar. It was kind of intimidating, but it was an experience.
Those are amazing animals. Like, what size are we talking there?
That boar is probably 400 to 500 pounds.
400 to 500 pounds.
Yeah, put him right in that ballpark somewhere.
Yeah. No, those aren't the ones you're selling. You're selling usually send to slaughter a smaller animal?
Yeah, we'd raise them. They're born in the spring, and they'd go to slaughter in the late fall, like around November or so. And so they'd go from, they're probably born at about I don't know, 2 or 3 pounds each. And when they go after 8 months, they're about 250 pounds.
Wow.
That's how fast that animal grows.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Sam, on the other hand, is still only about 19 pounds after 10 months.
Humans don't grow quite as fast. Good yeah. thing. Can you imagine trying to put clothes on a child that grew that fast?
Yeah. But it'll take him about, 3 or 4 years to be full size, so he still has a little bit more growing to do.
The boar, not
for
Sam.
For the boar, yeah.
Yeah, not Sam. Yeah. Sam's got another good 20
years.
Yeah,
the boar, that breed doesn't get as big as some, but that breed will, he'll probably fill out even more, and there'll be another 100 pounds or so where he'll fill out on, and just beef up even more.
Yeah, I can't wait to come back and see him when he's bigger.
Yeah, they're impressive.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, they're gentle too, so.
Yeah, I was surprised at how you could just interact with them, and they came running for their food and came running to visit us, and that was really cool.
Yeah.
And the ram, your sheep ram, he came and reminded me of a dog. He just came right over and wanted to be scratched. And
yeah, well, that's, you know, I think one of the important aspects of how we farm is that there's interaction with the animals. We show them kindness, and they treat us in return with kindness.
Right.
And you know, they have a really excellent life while they're here.
Yeah.
And I think that that they show us that by being gentle with us. They're not upset to see us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's not a stressful environment.
That's right. Yeah.
So you're not. Yeah, you're giving respect, and they're giving it back. And
yeah.
So part of that symbiosis of the system.
Yeah. Well, they take care of us, and we take care of them.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and they deserve that. I think it's an important part of the organic regulations that they're, you know, the animal welfare is an important part of it. But I think that, you know, was in our hearts before we decided to go certified organic. It was always how we raised animals growing up too, and to, you know, respect them because they're a lot easier to handle, and you don't have to be afraid of them. And
right.
Especially when you're handling, you know, a boar that size could be really dangerous.
Yes.
We had to pause there briefly because Sam bumped his mouth. He was cutting teeth, so he wanted to chew on the bench. Kind of. Anyways, we're back. The whole thing about, that's what I like to say, is I only eat animals that are happy while they're being raised. I don't want to eat something that's lived a stressful life because you don't know what happens to their hormones, and that's going into you and what's it doing to your body.
Yeah.
And so if you can eat the happiest animals that you can, I think that's going to be the best food for nourishment as well as for your soul and your conscience.
It's an ethical treatment, you know, that comes into play there.
Yeah. I know when I buy food from you guys at the farmer's market, I don't have to worry about it. I know that it's good because I've seen it. But you know, you go to a grocery store and you're not, you know. So I'd just rather not.
Yeah.
Well, it's really nice today just to be able to walk around and actually see them in their environment and where they've grown up and been, what they've been introduced to. So
yeah,
definitely changes. There's that disconnect of your food nowadays of where does it come from, and most people don't know. So
that's right.
It's nice to get into the farms and sort of see and experience a little bit of what's out there. I know as a chef myself, I spend so much time in the kitchen that I forget what's outside in the field. So
yeah, it makes such a difference to the meat, you know, just having it out running around, just because. If you think about it, you're eating muscle, and that muscle has to grow. And if they're, you know, wandering away in a barn, it's like the texture isn't the same. It's not as high in iron because they're not pumping blood through their muscle. They're not building it. So, yeah, it actually took a lot of tweaks to get the chicken run set up in such a way that we can convince them to go out, and it's peeling and stuff. But that's just, you know, part of the learning.
And you rotate your chicken.
Yeah, so they have fresh grass every.
It's not one big box that they're locked in. They get a travel out and experience the grasses. And
And they flap around and they build up strong breast muscles because they're flapping, and the wings actually have meat on them, and the legs are strong. And
they get to eat bugs and worms and whatever else they can find.
That's right. Their feed is certified organic, and there's no medications involved. So having animals on pasture actually, you know, allows sort of an immunity or an immune system to develop, and that is really useful for the animals, so that they don't need to be medicated for any problems that, you know, can pop up from, you know, being kept in a barn, where, you know, a disease could come through and really quickly, you know, decimate, you know, your crop.
Right.
And so having them, you know, outside and building up an immune system is really important to just the animal's health overall. And it allows us as organic producers to be able to, you know, go through that cycle without having to, you know, resort to, you know, antibiotics or any other medications.
Or having any to cull or do any of the, we've been really lucky, but I think it's also a real testament to the system that, you know, that they do, you know, people say that chickens don't eat grass, but as you guys could see, I mean, there was not a lot of grass in some parts of that run where they've been eating, and so that's why we do have to actually, you know, keep it, opening it up to new areas so that they have some fresh grass every time.
Yeah, they'll just scratch it right down to bare dirt. And there's nothing.
Yeah, and you want it to be able to grow back up.
For sure.
So, and they're just, you know, they get really content out there. It gives them some extra space, and they can get away from each other. It gives them some intellectual stimulation because they can, do I want to go inside or outside? And
right.
Oh, I'm going to chase, you know, it's hilarious sometimes watching them chase butterflies around and flies and whatever, and they just,
Are the chickens more inclined to stay indoors? Like, would they rather be indoors, or is it, do they?
No.
Not really.
They like to be outside. There's a lot, like Megan says, there's a lot of stimulus out there.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's room for them to run, and that's one of the things that you see when you, you know, introduce them to the outdoors at a young age is they like to, you know, sort of make those beelines and flap their wings and, you know, sort of run at each other and then run off to the side. And it's really playful, you know, kind of a time for them.
Yeah. Somebody catches a, you know, an earwig or whatever, and then the rest of them all start chasing it around trying to get it from them and it's tag
that's a
or
good
whatever.
Game of chase.
Yeah. So they're cool. Doing their thing.
Yeah.
It's just key to get them outside in the first, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of their life so that they actually do, you know, develop that urge before they get so big that they just get lazy.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they're bred to be meat birds, so they grow really quickly versus a laying hen.
Yeah. So by 6 weeks they're actually so heavy that if they haven't been running around, they won't, because their breast becomes just so like big and floppy that, and their legs are not, they're not bred to have strong legs. Their legs aren't strong enough to hold them up.
Right.
And so they just kind of, you know, like big fat teenagers really.
Yeah.
Not to mention like the importance of developing a cardiovascular system at an early age to support that.
Yeah.
That
they
body
need to have
size
strong
later
lungs.
On.
Right. Which helps in the health of your flock.
Yeah.
For coming
Yeah, it allows you to take that bird from, you know, one day old to 8 weeks with no trouble in between.
Right. And we can raise them for longer, too, like if we have to. We often will keep a few to get larger, like till 10 weeks or so. And commercially, those birds, by 10 weeks, they'd just be dying off because they get, you know, they have heart attacks and whatnot.
Right.
But we can raise them to 10 weeks easily if we want, you know, big Thanksgiving birds or whatever.
Right, yeah.
So, or that's what we make the sausage out of usually, is the bigger birds.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah.
A little chewier meat, but lots of extra.
And lots more bone.
Right.
If you're carving, it's flavorful too.
Right.
Like it really starts to taste like chicken by that age, I find.
Right. Yeah.
Because they start clucking, they start getting a little bit more hormonal maybe.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Something changes.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Do you find you have much loss in chickens? Like, you lose a few, or is it not?
We lose a few always. There's, I mean, the mortality rate that you expect is kind of higher than you might think, just because chickens are so embryonic when they're hatched, you know, like they're such simple creatures. So there's always some congenital problems. Right. But on the whole, I mean, I think our mortality last year was about, it was less than 2%, I think.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and that really was even with the little odd predator problems and stuff.
Right.
Factored in.
Last year was a terrible year for chicks too. Like there was
a glut
in the market in the United States, and so the U.S. was buying chicks from the hatcheries in Canada.
Oh yeah.
And so what we were getting was, you know, sort
the
of
leftovers.
The leftovers from the large producers, and we did well last year. We had a really good supplier who was able to access more local hatcheries, whereas before we were buying chicks that were coming on the plane from Edmonton.
Yeah, for the first year.
And that was terrible because,
you know,
those small animals have been without food or water for quite a few hours up in a cold hold.
Right.
And then you want to try to, you know, get them going again. And, I mean, you're literally like putting the beaks in the water and teaching them how to drink and get going. And
wow.
Whereas this seller who was bringing them from the hatcheries in the lower mainland, you know, they're within a few hours of being hatched. They're
oh,
here.
Yeah. Holy
and
cow.
So that makes a big difference, just the vitality of the animal, like right off the hop. You get them eating and get them drinking, get them into a warm environment, and they do really well then.
Cool. People always comment on how quiet they are because they just think chickens are loud usually. But when they're not stressed, they're quiet.
Yeah.
So we get
these
chicks and they're sitting there quietly, you know, having a little nap.
Yeah.
And all in a big bundle of level. Yeah, doing their little yoga. And it makes a huge difference to how well they do. So,
oh, yeah.
Wow. So yeah, having the local supplier has been really excellent for that. And especially getting us through that shortage last year. Because, yeah, like Chris was saying, I mean, even with the shortage, he was able to get us extra chicks to sort of make up for the poor quality and stuff. And, there were a lot of producers that had a really hard time and really high mortalities last year. But I think a combination of good quality chicks and just having perfected our housing and the feed and that getting that organized is really paid off in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
We've had really low mortality.
Just another year of experience under your belts.
It's a lot different. Even from when I was doing chickens before, you know, back before I left the farm originally, like we have a portable pen as well that we move around on the grass, and I used to use that as well. But we weren't using organic feed back then, and we still had pretty good numbers for mortality, but it was a lot harder to manage because I think the organic feeds just prepare them better for that kind of environment.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know how or why, but it just seems to work a lot better.
Huh.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
So you find it a lot of work to have the organic certified label on your product? Or is that sort of just how you do things? And
It's not that much work.
Well,
I mean, it's stuff that you should be doing anyways. You know, like you should be tracking what's coming in and what's going out. And, I mean, you're paying, you know, a few hundred dollars for certification. And that pays for somebody to come out and look at the farm and make sure that what you say is what you're actually doing. And other than that, it's no different. than if you didn't have, you know, a certification label on your product.
For us, it's what we would have wanted to do anyways. So, you know, it wasn't really so much a matter of it being more work or changing what we were doing or planning to do. It just means a little bit more paperwork and it kind of forces you to get it all done by February, which isn't a bad thing.
Right, yeah.
Because we get busy later on, right?
Say, you should be doing all this anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, making sure that your books are in order.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which and is what they want to see when they come out and,
yeah.
and audit us, which... Because we're only a few years in, they're coming out every year, and they come out, have a walk around, and they want to sit down with the books, and they want to see, you know, what your numbers are like throughout the year. They want to take a batch of chickens and go through it from the beginning to the end, from when you got them to when you take them out to slaughter,
mm-hmm.
and they want to, you know, make sure that the housing's adequate and that the feed is the proper feed, and... You know, it's not a lot more work to become certified organic. I'm actually a member of a new group of organic growers in the Comox Valley, and we've invited a few people to a couple of meetings, and talked to them about it, and, you know, offered to sort of guide them through the beginning stages of certification and, you know, kind of showing them, okay, this is what you're looking at for costs, and everybody kind of goes like, is that it? You
yeah.
know, I thought it would be a lot more than that. And,
yeah.
I think there's a bit of fear.
Yeah, people build it up in their heads.
It gets built up.
Yeah, I've got to do all this extra tracking. I've got to be on top of this and know about this. And I guess there are some challenges that go along just with knowing where your feed comes from. But I guess the stuff you should be doing anyways as a farmer.
Yeah.
Well, you're always looking for a better deal and whatever if you're a farmer anyway. So, I mean... It just narrows, really all it does is it narrows down the scope of what you can actually buy. So in some ways it's good because you can't spend as much time looking when there's only three, you know, organic feed producers in Western Canada to choose from.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and on the other hand, it opens up a market for you. That,
yeah, especially for
isn't
us.
Isn't available to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, for... I think for animal products, like any like dairy or meat products, it's kind of by the time you're adding that layer, you know, in the food web, that extra, you know, layer of feed that you're feeding to animals. What am I trying to say? Trophic layer. Your costs are kind of astronomically more than
right.
if you're growing vegetables, because the difference between organic and conventional small scale vegetable production, it's not that big of a difference, but for us, we're asking people to spend like more than twice sometimes of what they could buy at Thrifty's or
right.
or wherever
right.
and so having the certification kind of gives them that like definite peace of mind, and it gives us access to a wider range of people who might, you know, with a handshake you might be willing to spend twice as much for something, but with the certification and the handshake through the farmer's market, like, people can really feel confident that they're getting, you know, top quality product. And marketing is the most time consuming part, and, you know, like, I think we're similar to a lot of farmers, doing the marketing isn't really what we got into it
right.
to do, so having that sort of check mark gives us that assurance for people to, like, you know, they feel confident that they're getting that, and we don't have to feel like we're selling ourselves, as you know, beyond just having that
right.
as much.
Yeah.
It's a little bit less, you know.
Well, I know as a chef, it's always that connection of, we're so busy preparing food and cooking it, and farmers are always so busy growing it and producing it, that this it's very hard to find that middleman that's not trying to gouge everyone,
yeah.
you know, and so
mm-hmm.
you can get this very good quality product onto your restaurant dinner plate and
mm-hmm.
serve it to people and
mm-hmm.
have them enjoy, you know, your efforts that you put to make something amazing. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, it seems to be something that's necessary, right? That
middleman. There's so much going on, and
yeah.
you know, my biggest day is I usually have like an hour to do my order. So a lot of times it's phoning the big distributors, but they don't carry the small little things and the local things. So it's a lot of extra effort on my part to find them and get in and make those phone calls. So, so I understand where you guys are doing the whole marketing and having to sell your product. It's a
mm-hmm.
difficult issue. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's one of the areas between our two fields that, you know, is really necessary. And, you know, I just recently heard about somebody in Tofino who was doing that and how mm-hmm. well that was working. And it'd be interesting to see if that could happen here in the Comox Valley.
You know, yeah. And I've know some people that have been talking with them, and because the restaurateurs in Tofino were laughing because their fish gets caught on the docks right below their restaurants. It gets shipped yeah. to Victoria, where they sort it, and then they ship it back to Tofino. Oh,
it's incredible.
Which yeah. just seems ridiculous, yeah. right? Yeah.
Super ridiculous.
And there's a lot of things that happen like that, because yeah. it's a sorting, and it works in large scales, but it's... Mm-hmm. It's neat with the farmer's market. I think that's yeah. really... I'm always impressed with our farmer's market. I know you're both big members of the farmer's market. So.
Yeah. We're incredibly lucky here to have local processing as well. Because otherwise we would be, shipping our chickens, mm-hmm. on the ferry and whatever.
Right.
But, having Gunter's and Paradise Meadows locally so we can get all of our slaughtering and our custom processing done pretty much... here means that we don't have to have a middleman. We can sort of, we can do the driving around, and it's not as onerous as it would be.
It's got a cheek full of chew.
yeah.
Yeah, Sam's picking away in the garden here, digging in the dirt, pulling weeds for Mom. He's having a great time.
I think he almost looks like he just got a little wad of chewing tobacco in the corner of his mouth there.
He's quite chewed up, chew on but there. He can stuff it in.
So I want to talk about your hogs, because that was pretty cool to see them down there.
Yeah.
Explain a little bit about the breed, because it's unique from what you've told me. It is.
They are purebred Berkshire, and that is a heritage breed that just about died out in the last 30 years. And there's only probably, from what I know about it, maybe a dozen or so, or maybe a couple of dozen breeders that kept that breed alive during the 70s and the 80s when lean pork became the go-to.
Right, yeah.
And so the only way to survive as a pork producer was to, buy these very lean bred animals. And Berkshire is not a lean animal. They're if you let them, they can be very fat.
Yeah.
There's two types of pigs. You've got bacon pigs and you've got lard pigs. And bacon pigs are long. Yeah. And so that gets you a really long side that you can make a lot of bacon out of.
Right.
And lard pigs were raised, and this is going back a few hundred years, and they were prized for their lard because lard was used in a lot of different ways. Animal fat used to be used in everything from ointments to baking with it instead of butter to, right. I think they even made lamps with it.
Yeah.
They burned it as a lamp oil.
Yeah, they used to with whale oil, I know that. Yeah. So, yeah.
But one of the neat things about Berkshire is that as long as they don't get to that stage, they put a lot of fat through the muscle. So you get what's called intramuscular fat. And
right.
So what happens is when you take a look at the loin, instead of it being solid muscle tissue, there's little ribbons of fat all the way through it.
Oh, okay.
And
that beautiful marbling in it.
It's a beautiful marbling. It's like looking at a, AAA steak.
Wow.
That's the difference between that and... some cheap cut, and you see that when you cut through it, that there's just a little ribbon of it, everywhere through it. And so, when you go to cook that, that is an incredibly juicy and flavorful cut of meat.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's why they're prized, for the meat quality. And they happen to do really well on pasture. And so for our system, where we're rotating them through pastures, they can handle it. They can develop a nice thick coat, and they can be outside here in the winter with a good house to get into to get a dry night. They can be outside. They don't have to be kept inside a barn. So you get the advantage of having them on the pasture, which allows them access to a lot of different nutrients that they would never get in their feed. And like the chickens, it helps to build up a natural immunity to any diseases or viruses that can affect an animal. And, it is an ethical way to treat an animal, to have them outside. So they're suited to that, and they have the added benefit of being a really wonderful meat to cook with. Mm-hmm. And they're known to be very good mothers. This is our first time breeding them, and the sow did fairly well with it. She's definitely got her work cut out for her. She has, she's got a few things to learn about being a mom, but now that she's, you know, kind of figured that out, I can see that the next time's going to be a lot easier.
Yeah.
And the boar that's with her is a nice, gentle animal as well. And together they make a really interesting family unit out there. And, you know, they're living together. I think that probably to manage the breeding, we'd want to remove the sow from the boar at certain times, just so that we can sort of space out the period between litters. Mm-hmm. So that it's easier on the sow.
Right.
Because the piglets grow so fast, they can, you know, produce quite a few litters in a year. And you know, it's, you want your animals to be with you for a while, and if you were to really intensify like that, it, you know, it takes its toll on them. So that's a management practice that we're going to need to do.
Right.
And yeah, they're you know, a really interesting animal.
Yeah.
They're incredibly intelligent. They're incredibly kind and compassionate. They care for each other. Even if they're, you know, the one gilt cares for the piglets as if they're her own. She protects them.
Right.
And so they're tight-knit out there. They're a good group of animals.
Yeah, they were close-knit. You could tell that just the way they interacted with each other. A little bit of wrestling. Not wrestling, but nuzzling and poking. And
yeah, that's pretty normal. When you get in there and you're next to them, their way of saying hello is to give you a good nudge.
Yeah, I know. And the boar gave me a nudge. Yeah.
I thought you were going to hit that electric fence.
So, but I mean, you know, they're not aggressive or violent. It's just, it's their nature. Yeah. And I find, you know, that to look into their eyes is a lot like looking into a dog's eyes. There's an intelligence there that you just maybe don't find with cattle or horses or sheep maybe. There's just something incredibly unique.
Really?
Someone agrees.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited because before I leave tonight, I'm going to get on the list for a side for when it's slaughter time in the fall, so That's going to be awesome. I can't wait.
It is. You get a lot of meat.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, your third species you have here is your herbivores, your sheep, that we went down and could barely see because they were grazing in a pasture with grass as tall as we were nearly.
It's been a good wet summer or spring, so the grass is high.
But, what can you tell us about the sheep and what's kind of that influence on the farm? And
well, when Megan's family was here before, they raised sheep that had a lot of Romney blood in them.
No, and
okay, I thought that you guys raised Romneys.
No, we had one Romney ram towards the end, and the reason we got into Romneys was because they have a lot of really. They have a lot of really helpful genetic traits for this sort of bioregion. They're really resistant to foot rot, really resistant to worms. And internal parasites are a huge problem for sheep and cattle as well, just because they have all those stomachs and stuff. And
right.
Lots of crevices for worms to hang on into. And so that was why we sort of wanted to get into a Romney breeding when we got back here, because with the organic regulations and with practices, obviously we want to have something that can stand up to the wet wet winters and foot rot problems, and also the worms are worse in the rainy climate too, because they live on the grass and their larvae form, and so they have to they pretty much, you know, they only dry up in the summer, so that's only a couple months of the year that they don't have to have a bunch of worms getting into them.
Right.
So yeah. The sheep were always kind of my thing. I really like sheep just because of something about the way they interact with each other, that flock mentality. It's interesting. You know, they have their own dynamics, kind of like the pigs. They're not like people in the way they interact, the way, or dogs or anything, the way they interact like the pigs do, but there's something about them. There's a hierarchy in there. And they're a really interesting animal to work with because they provide, you know, wool, which is really important.
Yeah.
We feed them a little bit of grain, but the lambs pretty much, they're born in the spring just as the grass starts growing. And so they get all of that meat comes basically from their mums and from grass. And it's really high quality meat, you know, like delicious and full of iron. And so in terms of a farm system, kind of, you know, getting something for almost nothing, we have all this grass. And so that's the easiest way we can turn it into a product that we can sell, right?
Yeah. It doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, well, it does, but
but it doesn't.
Not as,
you know,
yeah, not as much inputs
all the time.
Yeah, not as much inputs for sure.
Yeah.
So it's a good way of cycling your nutrients too.
Right.
And just the way they take care of themselves, and we have Ivan as well. He's a Pyrenees, great Pyrenees.
Yeah.
Very friendly.
Yeah. livestock guardian dog to protect them from. Predators and stuff. So yeah, we wanted to get an animal that we had those sort of components for our system, you know, because it was basically we needed something to turn all that grass that we have into something sellable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without having to mow it
and turn into hay, which you said the field's not very good for that because it's kind of lumpy and pretty soft
and wet. Yeah. We don't have very good drainage down there.
Yeah.
We sort of got a nice mix of peat bog and gravel.
Right.
Hillside. So, perfect for sheep, though, because they can handle gravel, and they're a lot more agile than cows, you know, so they can handle the rocks and stuff, and they handle them very entertainingly, really.
Yeah.
The lambs do.
Yeah, they're
the castle.
They were just hidden away there, but as soon as we got up close, you could see them, and they come out, their little pink noses and pink ears, and
yeah,
they're very cute.
Yeah, that one ewe that we saw that came up first, her two lambs were both born with white hooves, white noses, white ears. Don't know how that happened, really, because the rest of them all have black hooves, and she's got some stripes of white in her hooves, but
yeah,
it's always interesting to see what genetics pop up, and the ewes we have are sort of crossbred Romney and something else in mixture, and but I think we're gonna get some purebred ones as well, because a lovely specimen, and he's been excellent. He's been gotten himself really fat. He's still growing. He's only two.
Yeah.
He's just in excellent condition using just the natural garlic warmer, and he's been excellent on his feet all winter. So that's really what we want, is to have animals that can be lower maintenance.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I had one question I wanted to ask. How many pairs of gumboots do you own?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh man, I don't know how many we own, but
yeah,
only use one.
I have a couple pairs, but
yeah,
I have two pairs of town gumboots. one of them has a leak, so mostly just use the other ones. And I have, same for the farm, I have a new good pair and an old crappy pair that I'll be using for cutting them down for the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing like a pair of cut-off gumboots.
Yeah. I've got a pair with liners, fleece liner. And then I've got a spare pair, which doesn't fit anymore. that I'm holding on to pass on to somebody who will fit them. Maybe Natalie will fit them.
Full assortment.
Then I've got another pair around that I haven't decided what I'm going to do with. They're just not as comfortable as the other ones, so.
She's a real gumboot connoisseur.
Yeah. I can't get them. I can't get rid of them, is the thing. If I could thin them out. But you got to have a good winter pair. You got to have an everyday pair.
Yeah.
And I've got my market pairs, because you can't wear your farm, manure-covered boots to the farm market.
No, that's
it's
right.
Not,
it doesn't show up.
Not good biosecurity.
No.
not good food safe. At one point, we actually had separate gumboots for the chicken house. And then the rest of the farm, because of the biosecurity rules, that hasn't really stuck, because it's just not practical really for the number of chickens we have to really worry about those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's seven pairs.
Seven pairs.
That's okay.
Seven.
Thanks for answering that. Yeah. That's a lot of gumboots.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, what are your plans for the future for the farm?
Well, we're definitely getting more into sheep, and I think more pigs too.
More pigs.
I would like to get some scobies. I've been doing bedding plants too. Bedding plants are sort of my little sideline. To sell at the farmer's market, I have like a bit of a heritage tomato collection. And what else are we gonna do? Barley. And
that's the thing. Ideally, we'd be, producing more of our own feed here, because that's the hardest nut to crack. And it costs a lot to bring feed in. So if you can do it right where you're feeding them, it, lowers your costs a lot. Yeah. So, and we have control over it too.
Lowers your footprint.
Mm-hmm.
On everything.
It does. So. Yeah. That's one of the things, growing barley and combining it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
That's kind of looking at that idea next, I guess.
And then the big picture, hopefully, would be able to have a rotation where somebody, not us, wants to grow vegetables, can come in, take advantage of all the manure that we'll have, grow some vegetables, also grow some field crops like the barley and probably mangels. Which are like a large forage beet. They're basically sugar beets that we can feed to the pigs and the sheep, and then do that as a rotation in the market garden area of the farm, which is kind of a nicer soil.
Yeah.
Growing vegetables on, and then use that also for pigs, as part of the rotation, and then potentially, still do the chickens, maybe get some ducks, grow a lot of different types of meat to bring that nutrient cycling in and the inputs in the form of feed, because bringing feed in is expensive, but it's still cheaper than buying fertilizers.
Yeah.
Organic fertilizers and getting organic manure. You kind of have to grow your own.
Yeah, for sure.
So having partnerships with the farm, because obviously, 100 acres is a lot for a couple.
Yeah,
it's a lot to manage. We have a lot of help from our my mom and stepdad and Chris's parents also. Sam one day will be helping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. How can we forget you, mister? But, yeah.
Okay, I think we should wrap up, because I think Sam's had enough of sitting here listening to us talk.
Sam's done, so.
Well, thanks for the tour and the visit. It was a great chat.
And if people want to get your product, the Farmer's Market.
Yeah, we're in the Grower's Guide, too.
In the Grower's Guide.
And you have a website?
We have a website. It's halsteadfarm@gmail.com.
Excellent.
Or halsteadfarm.ca.
Yeah, I'll link that.
Horribly out of date.
The...
because we're not good at marketing, as I said.
Yeah. I'll link your webpage on our page, and so people can get in touch with you.
Yeah, cool.
Well, thank you both for coming out and showing interest in what we're doing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really excellent to, have a chef come out and get to see that.
It's great to be here. So, yes, thank you for having us out here.
And the rain held off.
Yay. Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thanks for listening to the Edible Valley, and we'll see you next time.
Good night.